and welcome everybody to this episode of Let's Clear the Air. I feel like I'm in a unusual role starting off the podcast. This is usually Adam's job, but I'll do my best to fill Adam's seat and kicking us off. One of the reasons I do want to kick us off is because I'm responsible for today's guest. And so I know you guys are going to appreciate the conversation we have with Mike. Just as a reminder, my name is Stuart Salters. I'm on the staff at GPA Midstream Association. And as always, joined by Adam Murray and Brian Nix. So guys, thanks for joining us. But before we get into the conversation, let me introduce Mike. Mike is at the National Association of Manufacturers, or the NAM, as it is known in the DC bubble, I guess. But as the name implies, NAM represents all the manufacturers out there in the United States. And so you can give us a few minutes, Mike, whenever we kick off with questions about who your members are and kind of where they're located and all that kind of stuff. But before you joined the NAM, though, you were on the Hill. So Mike worked for a handful of congressmen. I think most recently you worked in the House for an Ohio member, and I'm blanking on who that was.
Yeah, Mr. Latta.
But you can fill in the details. Okay, yeah, that's right, Congressman Latta. So, Mike, tell us a little bit more about the NAM, and then I might give Adam and Brian some opportunity to ask you some questions.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Stuart, and thanks, Adam and Brian, for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. So the National Association of Manufacturers, we are one of the largest national trade associations in the United States. We were founded back in 1895, and we represent 13 million people who manufacture things in the United States. So these are the people who make things. We have about 14,000 members, including over 200 plus board of directors. So this board, it's publicly available. You'll see there are folks like Johnson & Johnson, U.S. Steel, ExxonMobil, Smucker's, Rockwell Automation. You know, our members range from large to small. And in fact, our small and medium manufacturers represent about 90% of our total membership. These are the folks, you know, your 50 or less employees, you know, less than $1 billion in revenue. These are the folks that members of Congress and policymakers want to hear from, but also, you know, our swath of membership represents a huge portion of U.S. economic output. So in addition to individual member companies, we also have about 260 members who are vertical manufacturing associations. So these are the folks that make up our Council of Manufacturing Associations. So we like to bring folks together and convene everyone under our one NAM umbrella. We also have partnerships with associations, either chambers or manufacturing associations in all 50 states, as well as the Puerto Rico. So this helps us because the NAM is more at the federal level. We can work with our state partners when any issues come up that our members care about on the state level. So again, because of the breadth of our membership, we do advocate on pretty much every single issue area that impacts every industrial sector of the economy. And one of our main principles that our CEO, Jay Timmons, likes to talk about is that the NAM is about policy, not politics, personalities, or process. This means that, you know, we focus solely on engaging on policy. So that allows us to work with both sides of the aisle and policymakers who want to get things done. So we can be at the table no matter who's in the White House, no matter who's in control of Congress. Because to be completely frank, you know, the manufacturing brand is very popular, and folks want to be seen trying to help and boost manufacturers and manufacturing in the United States, because these are the folks in local communities. It's direct input to our economy, and it really is about trying to drive the United States to economic leadership around the world. So that's kind of a snapshot of who we are. Happy to dive in deeper about, you know, our different members when it comes to the issues that I care about. I am very much focused on the energy and natural resources and environment portfolio of the NAM. We have a lot of members who use energy, who produce energy, who transport energy. And so it's an exciting time.
Interesting. It seems like it covers a pretty broad brush of the entire industry, both blue collar and white collar jobs as well. Can you talk about how you guys kind of get into your development process and in the studies that you do and kind of how you approach those?
Every 4 years, we come up with these board approved policies. We go through a process, an internal process, a review process of what are our principles? What are our guiding principles? What do we stand for as an organization? And this is very much member driven. So we, my job and others, my colleagues who handle other issues, it's to kind of convene our membership to figure out what we want to focus on over the next 4 years. What has been working? What hasn't been working? What needs to be updated? And so this is really the foundation for all of our work is our board approved policies. And so from there, once we go through a process to input and feedback and then ultimately approval from our board, we then go out and execute. And so the way that we do that is, we're very much fact and data driven. So we run a quarterly survey amongst our members about important topics. You know, what's the feeling in the manufacturing sector? How are things going? What are the top issues that companies care about? And then that will help inform kind of where we need to focus or who we need to reach out to in the government to try and tell the story of what needs to be done or what doesn't need to be done. Very much focused on using that survey. And then, one thing we're really focused on is talking about the economic impact of a certain policy towards the country, towards a state, towards congressional district. The topics can vary, whether it's energy, whether it's trade, whether it's taxes, but we try and tell the story, personal stories from manufacturers backed up by data using some of this research about where the economic impacts are. So for example, last year when Congress was debating and considering the tax legislation, the One Big Beautiful Bill, we commissioned a study that talked about if Congress did not renew the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions from 2017, what would be the impact all the way down to the congressional district? And so talking about taxes going up, for businesses, for individuals, by a certain amount, if Congress did not act. And we were very successful in getting that information into the hands of policymakers that ultimately, I believe, helped drive us towards success and seeing passage of that bill.
So, Mike, what are some of the top concerns and focus from the NAM? Is it the NAM or NAM? I'll say it right.
So I say NAM. Within the NAM, we say NAM, but Stuart was kind of alluding to, and maybe prior before I joined, folks called it NAM, and people still call it NAM to me, completely fine. But yeah, we say NAM. So topics, this year, and actually this Congress, I should say, since President Trump was elected, and then the new Congress took office, we've been focusing on a comprehensive manufacturing strategy. So the first part of that I already alluded to was tax reform and getting permanency and predictability when it comes to our tax policies. You know, our members, they needed that to be able to figure out where they need to invest, if they can invest. Otherwise, they would hold back and that would stunt manufacturing growth in the United States. So taxes was a big part, and we were very happy with getting that passed and signed into law last summer. Trade is an issue that our members are very tuned into and concerned about. The impact of tariffs, what does that do for our members who are trying to get the inputs that they need to manufacture here in the United States? And if they can't get those inputs, then they have to get it from somewhere else. And so then they're facing tariffs to get that. What is that impact then on their business and how much are they paying? And you have the IEEPA tariffs, the 232 investigation. So there's a lot of uncertainty around trade. So that is certainly an issue that's keeping our members engaged and our staff working, trying to present solutions and options to the administration, to policymakers, to Congress about, you know, how manufacturers can succeed at the same time as the president pursuing his trade agenda. So we do have this program. It's called the Manufacturers Accelerator Program. Basically, to the point I was just making, if you want to invest in the United States, boosting manufacturing here at home, and you need inputs that you can't get here, whatever you are importing to follow through on those investments, it would be able to come in duty free under a license that the government can issue. They already have this power to do it. And so we've just been talking about this and socializing it with them. And we've got a lot of positive feedback, but we're not there yet. Trade is another big piece. Regulations, rebalancing regulations. Under the previous administration, we saw what we call an onslaught of regulatory activity. You know, this ranged from Clean Air Act issues, from a lot of EPA stuff, chemicals issues, things that really impacted our members and increased costs for them. So with this new administration, we've seen a lot of great progress and appreciate their focus and emphasis on the regulatory landscape. Again, I say rebalancing regulations, not deregulation, because we are an industry that desires predictability and certainty. And you know, we want to be good stewards of our communities, of our environments. You know, we don't want to just say we don't need any regulation. No, that we need workable regulations. We need the government working with us to hear our impact, something they might not have thought about when they were coming up with a regulation, you know, hearing from us and making sure we're at the table so that you aren't putting some burden, some regulation in place that, for example, the previous administration put it's the PM2.5, the fine particulate matter, new standard at EPA under the Clean Air Act. This is a permitting process under the Clean Air Act, and basically they lowered the standard down to what naturally occurs at background levels. So for our advanced manufacturers who are trying to build up chips facilities, semiconductors, you know, components.
Paintments. Experience of the paintments.
What? Yeah, we're running into that too with all of our plant permits. Same exact thing.
Yeah, and even if you are, you know, able to comply with the standard, then currently, like if you were in attainment status, in order to get the permit, you have to have that headroom and you're not able to obtain that permit because you would go over the previous standard. And so the goals of trying to build up manufacturing in the United States, going up against some of these regulations that didn't necessarily comport with reality of what's going on out there. You know, you have international transport of emissions from other countries, you have wildfires, you have attempts at wildfire mitigation efforts. None of this is really being considered when coming up with these standards and when issuing these permits. And so, and not to mention the fact that industrial sources are very much a small minority of actual emissions for PM or for ozone. A lot of it is naturally occurring, or again, from these exceptional events. And so that, you know, that's one example of one of the regulations that we've been pushing back on. And we appreciate this new EPA taking a look and revisiting that. And hopefully we'll have some success there. And then finally, I'll mention, you know, my issue area, which is on energy and energy dominance. We really appreciate that. When President Trump came in, you know, he set up the National Energy Dominance Council, really putting an emphasis on not just energy security or energy independence, but energy dominance, really trying to unleash our members to be able to produce, to be able to use, to be able to contribute to, you know, a more energy secure country. Because, you know, if we're able to control our destiny with energy, then that helps us address problems or challenges, I should say, with data center growth, greater utilization of artificial intelligence. Having this competition for electrons doesn't really help everyone. And so if you can unleash American energy through increased production, grid modernization, but also more energy efficiency, you can really achieve all the goals that you need for your traditional manufacturers and traditional manufacturing growth, as well as addressing issues with data centers. And because they do suck up a lot of power. I know there's a lot of innovative solutions out there and trying to address that challenge itself within the data centers. But in the meantime, projections show that the energy demand is just going to keep going up. And so how do we address those challenges? So that's what my focus has been. And a lot of that is to unleash that. You do need to reform our permitting system and our permitting processes. It takes 80% longer than other developed nations to obtain a permit in the United States. And that's just not acceptable for the goals and the ambition that we have. So we're working hard on that.
No, this is great. No, Mike, appreciate you sharing all that stuff. I guess maybe if we can pull on that data center thread a little bit more. You guys recently did a report where you kind of focused on the manufacturing roadmap to AI and energy dominance. And so I guess if you're a manufacturer, member of NAM, what are you looking for from an energy source? What kind of characteristics? You know, talk a little bit about what's a manufacturer think about when he wants energy.
Yeah. So that report, if anyone wants to read it for themselves, it's at nam.org/AI. At that landing page at the top, there is a link to the report. So within that report, we basically outline four key pillars or principles that we're looking at in order to achieve energy and AI dominance. The first being permitting reform, which I mentioned. The second, unleashing energy dominance. The third, talking about grid reliability, and not just reliability, affordability and resiliency. And then fourth, the right regulatory environment for AI principles. So in talking about the type of energy that we need, again, it's reliability, affordability, resiliency. Manufacturers, they need a source of energy to power their operations that they can count on. It's very costly if you have to shut down production lines or smelters or furnaces, because these are types of equipment that you can't just quickly turn back on. So if there are issues with the grid, issues with receiving the energy to power these assets, then that costs time, that costs money. Having a reliable source of energy. And we talk about all of the above strategy. So that's basically everything. We're not ruling anything out. We have members who, you know, like wind and solar, and we have members who are in oil and gas, and we have nuclear and geothermal and hydrogen. So we think you need all of these sources in order to maintain that reliability, fully backed up by baseload power. So oil and gas, nuclear, we need to have these. And we're very much also very focused on battery storage to help with the grid, with controlling and ensuring reliability on the grid. And then resiliency goes along with that, being able to handle the stress that can come from extraordinary events, weather, cyber, physical, anything that could impact operation to the grid. You know, our members need to see resiliency. And then affordability. Now, this is the key word here in Washington, out, you know, on the campaign trail. You know, you have to be able to pay for your energy. Like, one of the most attractive things about the United States and trying to bring back manufacturing has been our electricity prices. And so being able to ensure that a company, when they make their investment and have high skilled labor and paying folks well, they need to be able to get affordable energy to make up for some of those costs with bringing back operations. And so again, affordability, if you're not producing enough and keeping up with demand, you have that competition again between, you know, manufacturers, traditional manufacturers, data centers, you know, residential. We don't want prices to go up for everyone. And I think this will only be a more hot button issue as we go into the midterms this fall. I think President Trump came in on a platform of addressing affordability. And so I think this will continue to percolate and be important to folks. And then I'll say one last thing is sustainability. So our members, some other than others, they have, they might be public companies. So they have commitments to sustainability desired by their investors. And again, our members want to be good stewards of the environment. So using their resources and using energy efficiently and doing it in a responsible way that make sure the environment stays clean, the air stays clean, the water stays clean. So making sure there are some sustainability goals. That's some of our members do really care about that.
So all the manufacturing inputs that have to go into building these data centers, maintaining them, all of that good stuff. Looks like from your report, there's quite a bit of stuff I didn't even think about, like concrete and steel, right? You just kind of don't think about those things. But when you build those data centers, there's a lot of this stuff. So how is the energy need for the manufacturers to make the things for the data centers that also need all these energy needs taken into account? Like, you know, there's so many different kinds of components, different kinds of companies. They all need their energy. The data centers are obviously going to need their energy. How does that all intertwine?
Yeah. So our membership, again, it's made up of those folks who operate the data centers, but also the supply chain that feeds into it, the components manufacturers. And so we see a lot of interest lately in some manufacturing facilities, data centers as well, but also other facilities, maybe some of these more energy intensive facilities looking to co-locate some of their energy assets to be able to have production where their facility is, whether that's behind the meter or what, to be able to kind of cut down on costs for transmission and also for transportation of energy. And so we have seen some folks interested in making investments there and in exploring some of these agreements that they can make to produce their own energy and maybe even whatever they don't use for their facility, possibly feed back into the grid itself. Now, there are questions that arise there, and I don't think the debate is settled about how best to handle that. I know FERC is looking at a lot of these issues, so it's something where we're watching closely and our members have expressed interest in. Again, where we want our members to be able to have access to whatever type of energy source that they want. Again, these energy intensive facilities, you know, whether that's nuclear or natural gas or oil, or if they want to install their own solar panels or wind turbines or have their own battery storage on site. We're trying to ensure the policy landscape is such that they can pursue what they want to pursue or what their company dictates and what their operations dictate that they need.
You had a couple of reports released. I think one of them addressed the permitting specifically. Bottleneck to breakthrough, I think, is the other report. What were sort of the findings and you know, if there are any outcomes on the permitting side, what are you guys seeing on that front? You know, you mentioned it takes longer to permit stuff, or permitting is one of the biggest issues that they have. So what are you guys seeing with that?
Yeah. And I think what we're seeing too is, you know, permitting is a big umbrella term. So when we're talking about permitting reform, it's not just NEPA, which is National Environmental Policy Act. It's also the Clean Water Act. It's the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act. You know, we're trying to approach this from a comprehensive standpoint where if you don't have to go through the NEPA process, but you can't obtain a permit under the Clean Air Act because of PM 2.5 or ozone or other non-attainment issues, there's been great progress on getting some of these reforms done and there's been talk. But for us, it's really about trying to find a legislative solution with bipartisan buy-in to address all of these issues. I know it's a Herculean task. You know, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act are very historic statutes, and there are some folks who think we shouldn't even touch it at all. To be honest, there's talk that, you know, the health concerns, maybe these standards should be zero. Like, if you're really truly only focused on health outcomes, then yeah, maybe the standards should be zero. You know, what are the problems then if you don't have jobs, if you don't have economic growth, if you don't have tax revenue from investments in business and manufacturing? And so you have to strike the right balance that we've found. And we think that there are reasonable voices in the policy debate on both sides that understand this point. And so we're trying to tell that story that, again, on Clean Air Act issues, if a manufacturer is doing everything that they can with scrubbers, with technology to reduce their footprint, and then they're still, the area that they're in is in non-attainment because of a wildfire or because of, you know, they're trying to combat wildfires or because of emissions from China or Canadian wildfires, we need to have a process to be able to take that into consideration so that you don't just bottle up some of these investment opportunities and these manufacturing opportunities. Because at the end of the day, like when talking about like the semiconductors and some of these energy projects, you know, there are national security implications too, not just economic implications. You know, the whole reason behind the CHIPS Act was to make sure that the United States was not, you know, reliant on China or, you know, Taiwan, if there are issues between China and geopolitical issues, to make sure we have our own supply, domestic supply here. You know, if you have Clean Air Act standing in the way of those investments, those, you know, tens of billions of dollars in investments, you know, we have to work together to find a solution here. Again, I think there are folks that understand that from both sides of the aisle. And we're hopeful that as permitting talks continue in Congress, that the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act can also be in the conversation as well as NEPA, which is getting a lot of attention right now. Chairman Westerman from the House Natural Resources Committee, he had a bill, the SPEED Act, that passed the House. We were very much in favor of and supported, and we appreciate all of his efforts. It was a bipartisan bill, along with Jared Golden from Maine and several other Democrats who joined. So we appreciate that. We think it's a great way to get the Senate now to get involved. And I know there's been some great conversations going on there between Chair Capito at the Environment and Public Works Committee and her ranking member, Sheldon Whitehouse, as well as the Energy and Natural Resources Committee with Chairman Lee and ranking member Heinrich. So we want to support those talks and be as helpful as possible and lending the manufacturing voice to make sure they know why this is a issue that needs to be addressed this year. Again, going back to the data centers and energy demands, you know, we can't keep putting this off. We have to address this to make sure energy is affordable and then everyone can access energy to continue to grow.
So Mike, are these permitting hurdles and things, are they typically mostly found at the federal level? Is there any, you know, issues with your group on local issues as well, state laws, things like that? I mean, are they nimble enough to, if there is a state with some permitting issues, laws that are really prohibitive, that they can move around enough, move to different states? Or is it also kind of a local issue with all the permitting?
Yeah, there definitely are state and local issues as well. We haven't necessarily weighed in too much on specifics. The only time we really have is when it kind of feeds up to a federal statute like the Clean Air Act. I know Arizona, Wisconsin, there's been some, and Colorado, there's been some issues with non-attainment, Texas as well. Basically, what we've tried to do is be a facilitator and work with our state partners or our members who are located in those states, make sure they're connected with the EPA nationally or with their regional EPA offices to make sure that they're working to address the issues. And if something comes up at the federal level that needs to be changed, we're there to help. But yeah, I know there are some state issues that are standing in the way as well. And we're working with our grassroots, grass tops, and our local partners to try and address those.
You mentioned energy dominance and kind of the term that I guess the Trump administration has highlighted or maybe came up with. What does that mean to a member of the NAM?
When we're talking about energy dominance, it's really on a national level, the way that the United States can control its own destiny when it's powering the economy. You know, we do live in a global market. Global energy prices are subject to that market, but we have full faith in the United States that if we can outproduce the world in energy generation and use the energy we already have more efficiently, then that can lower our exposure to some of these shocks around the world, OPEC, Russia, obviously what's going on with Venezuela. There's a lot of global factors that can come to it, but you know, if we can take care of what we need to take care of here, then that helps our members and helps reduce their exposure. It also reduces our dependency on other countries. Again, you know, we're not where we were in the early 2000s or in the 1970s, where you know we are really beholden to OPEC what's going on in the Middle East, but it's still a global market that impacts everything. And price of oil is down. The barrel price of a barrel of oil is at historic lows right now, and so that impacts our domestic producers. And so being able to address these issues and lower that exposure to risk would help us make us dominant. And going back to permitting reform, some of the tax incentives and resources that we think would have been helpful and still are helpful, the strategic energy and manufacturing incentives, by building up our domestic capacity here, by incentivizing our domestic capacity here, that's a way for us to again, be what we say, quote unquote, energy dominant. And in order to do all of this, we can have all the best policies in the world on paper, but we're very much committed to building up our skilled workforce to be able to actually do the jobs to make sure we can become energy dependent, through production, through on the shop floor, out in the fields, out in the Gulf of Mexico, doing everything possible and having the folks, the actual people, to be able to do it is one of our top priorities. And we have at the NAM, we have a nonprofit. It's our sister association, but it's technically under the NAM umbrella. They're called the Manufacturing Institute, and their entire job has been focusing on workforce development, building up programs, going out into communities and actually training folks and working with companies, working with educational institutions, working with anyone possible to make sure that we fill the jobs, because I know there are thousands of unfilled manufacturing jobs from a given month. And so we can have the greatest tax laws in the world. We can have the greatest, permitting system in the world. But if you don't have the people to actually carry out the work, you're not going to be able to achieve your goals. So that workforce is key to achieving any of this.
So Mike, we only covered a certain portion of everything that NAM does. Before we wrap here, is there, you can give out the website again, but is there any other, items that are kind of showing up on your radar that people can look into on the website or elsewhere?
Our website, NAM.org, if you want to find our roadmap to AI and energy dominance, it's NAM.org/AI. We have folks doing great stuff in the chemical space. I didn't even get to talk about that. This year, Congress has to look at reauthorizing some chemical policy and these chemistries go into all of our products. And when talking about permitting reform, there are also issues with the approval process for some of these chemistries, both new and existing chemistries. And we're trying to do a lot of work there and work with policymakers to streamline the process to make sure, our members who are making these chemistries have some certainty about their projects, what they're doing, and then ultimately getting things to market to be able to help achieve a lot of these goals. We're very excited to continue to work on these issues this year. It's going to be interesting because it is an election year, but I still think there's a lot of good things that can get done. And again, we're committed to getting good policy. So we're not going to get involved in all the mischief or all the daily news cycle of some of the more petty things that are going on. But if that impacts our members, if there are issues that our members care about, we will be there to address them and work through those problems. But it's really about trying to use our industry, our brand, to be able to tell this story about American manufacturing.
So Adam usually wraps the podcast episodes with a question, and help me if I get it wrong, Adam. But it's like, if you were to come back in a year, is that right? Do we usually do a year?
Couple years, yeah, whatever.
Okay. Couple years, if you come back and you're excited to share an update on what we talked about today, what would have happened and what would you want to tell us to be positive and share some good news?
Yeah, I think in a year from now, if we can have positive movement on permitting reform, I think, the sky's the limit for our industry, because that'll mean 1 year we got taxes done, Next year, we got permitting done. So now when we make a promise as an industry, if policymakers follow through on what we're asking for, then it's on us to then deliver. So I would love to come back and say, we got what we needed, and now we're rolling up our sleeves and we're getting to work. So really excited, and we want to make sure to see that happen.
That's awesome. Well, fingers crossed. Yeah. We can invite you back next year, and we'll talk about all the legislation and rebalancing regulation. I might have to steal that. That's good. I like it.
So, please do.
Hey, everyone. We're trying a new format here where we do a little bit of recap of our conversation, have a little offline or better online discussion without the guest on, where we kind of recap what was said and kind of go over some different nuggets that we thought were interesting. And so we welcome into the room Kevin Groom, who also produces the show. You may have heard him on a couple of podcasts as well. So Kevin, thanks for jumping in. But yeah, guys, really interesting conversation. Brian, first off, what's your gut thought there?
I think it's kind of amazing how you have, like we were talking earlier, just so many different members in that group, and it runs the gambit now across everything, and how there's so much consensus on my big take was permit reform. I mean, regulation reform. It's just, it's kind of cool how you can have a nuclear facility and a gas refiner, like you were mentioning, Stuart Smucker's making peanut butter, right? And they're having issues with the same things, right? Different permits, right? Different regulations, but just overburdening. And just kind of how interesting that, I guess, for quite a while, there just hadn't been a lot of push on that. And as of recently, there's a lot of push on it. And it's nice to see. And that's been such a big topic that everybody's been discussing. So I thought that was very neat.
Yeah, I mean, you see this demand, right? I mean, he highlighted the data centers that are feeding this AI boom or whatever it is. But I mean, you can't discount what's already there, right? And what's happening, whether it's food because the population's growing, or energy because people are building more houses and things like that. And so one of the things I wanted to highlight is, he did a good job kind of talking about some of the policy conversation. And he mentioned the Speed Act introduced by Congressman Westerman and Congressman Golden, I guess Chairman Westerman, because he's the chair of one of the big committees here in D.C. But I think, just to kind of pull on a little bit of a thread, he talked about that legislation, right? So what's being talked about in Congress as opposed to what's being talked about in the administration. And I think it's unfortunate in our country that we've had this just back and forth with regulation. So what the administration's over. And so what Mike was trying to highlight was, we need changes in the legislation. We need changes in the statute, because that's going to last, right? You have a Republican president now, who knows what happens 2 years from now in 2028, could be a Democrat, could be a Republican, but to have some kind of long lasting policy is what makes sure we still have peanut butter, and what makes sure, these data centers have the power that they need. And so, yeah, he did a good job talking about what's going on, but I thought it was good to highlight why there is such a focus on the legislation.
So, Stuart, one of the questions that I had as I was listening to that was just about, and you would be the guy to know this. So the Speed Act addressed the National Environmental Protection Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are there legislative vehicles out there, proposals that you're aware of, that address some of the other legislation that he talked about, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the other environmental legislation?
Yeah. And I'll try not to dive into the weeds, because I'm probably the only one that really cares about this stuff. But just at a high level, there definitely are concepts that have been introduced, legislation that's been introduced. In the House, there was some legislation in the House of Representatives, some legislation introduced and passed. It came from the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and it related to the Clean Water Act, related to some of the responsibilities the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has. And so, if anybody wants to email me offline, happy to get into the details. But just at a high level, it just makes those processes more efficient, makes them more streamlined, rebalances them, if you will. And again, we're in the same situation, right? So we have a bicameral Congress. What passes in the House has got to pass to the Senate. But if there's changes in the House, changes in the Senate, they got to come together, work that out to get one bill through both chambers. So we're only at the 50-yard line with all this legislation. It's still got to go through the Senate.
You know, looking at it from a business perspective, right, I thought he brought up, and I was very glad to hear that they're aware and getting feedback from their constituents on, you know, policy, not politics, right? Like, I'm sure when you have 13 million members and they range from peanut butter to oil refining, that you get a broad variety of information and preferences and things like that. But I was really happy to hear policy, not politics. I mean, they're really working on an operations level, right? Trying to make it easier to operate. And then the other really cool thing I thought he said was predictability, right? It's really hard to run a small business, which many of these, you know, I think you said 80% of their members are smaller businesses. You know, it's really hard to run a business when you can't predict what's going to happen every 4 or 8 years, right? And now it's almost down to every two with the midterm elections. And so happy to hear, you know, that they're conscious of that and that, you know, those out there like myself who traditionally work for smaller or mid-sized companies are being represented and that is being heard. So, you know, I kind of smirked during the podcast because I was like, that it's really hard to have your customers say, hey, we're waiting until election year because we don't know what's going to go on, right? Yeah. Like, whereas at least if you can become predictable, you can figure it out, right? And then the other part is just low pricing. You know, I think given all the data center energy usage, water usage, and things like that, it's like, what is going to happen personally to our home energy bills, but also to, you know, welding companies use a lot of electricity. Manufacturing companies use a lot of electricity to heat and to cool or to do whatever they're doing. And so, you know, keeping that pricing competitive is in the spotlight, but it's kind of adjacent, right? We want to bring manufacturing here, but you also don't want to crush the individuals who are paying their home energy bills. And so, again, I thought it was a great conversation. Like we always say, we could have talked to him for 2 more hours and we probably kept going.
We were kind of talking about it a few seconds ago, but Brian, you talked about reliability. And so I think that affordability aspect, we don't want to lose sight of, but also the reliability aspect. And Mike said it, right? And I totally agree. I mean, we got the supply, we have the demand. It's kind of that in between, right? And mm-hmm. So it making sure we fill in that gap of getting the supply to the demand, both to maintain affordability, but also reliability. Natural gas plays a big part in that. Propane plays a big part in that. And it's so hopefully everybody's not losing sight of that.
Yeah. And Stuart, to your point on that, polling has indicated that the top issue for consumers is reliability above affordability. So we got the three pillars we talk about sometimes, the reliability, the affordability, and then sustainability. And reliability and affordability are the two most important factors to consumers. And you think about it, I mean, paying your own electricity bill is important, but knowing that it's going to stay on is critical.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the hope, I guess, from the conservative philosophy is the invisible hand of the free market will marry those two, right? You've got the supply, you've got the demand, the intermediate will work out. And I hope that's true. I do see what's kind of interesting is that he alluded to a little bit, it's just how many players are involved on that, right? Just the power generation, the transmission lines, and then you've got all the state and local regulations, federal regulations. So I think probably my guess in the future is we're going to see a lot more focus on if the free market is not going to do that as quick as we need it, because like, just look how fast all this data center stuff blown up just in the last 2-3 years. I mean, projects everywhere. There's so much money in it. And these utility companies and all that, they're not designed for that, right? So there's got to be a lot of, I think, help, you know, some sort of whatever that looks like, legislation, policy to get that moving faster and more forward.
So, Ryan, your point about the markets, the invisible hand of the markets, leads me to another topic that he mentioned. And this is one that's been popular since the 2024 campaign, is that the concept of energy dominance, right? And Mike mentioned that oil prices have been very low, and that actually is something that affects America's ability to produce oil and gas as well, because a lot of gas is associated, produced as like a, just associated sort of comes along. They're really trying to produce oil. They also produce a lot of gas. And so you guys are all like essentially technical and sales experts, I guess, or business development experts in the industry. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that relationship between oil prices and that concept of energy dominance, U.S. production, all that kind of stuff. Just my background, I came into the oil and gas industry with an upstream association, and I became acquainted with the concept of break-even points for oil and gas production. And so I'm just curious, again, what your guys' thoughts are about that relationship between price production and the concept of energy dominance.
I mean, I think it, not to simplify it too much, but, you know, I don't want market control. I'm a free market person as well, but it's like, you know, I think the CEO of Continental, Harold Gamm, or whoever, wrote a paper a long while back that basically said at $70 oil and at $4 gas, he can do whatever he wants, you know, and make money, and it doesn't really put a strain on the economy too bad, and all of those things. I think that was actually repeated in the series Landman here recently, if I remember correctly. But, you know, again, I fall back on the predictability. Like, it can go up and it can go down, you know, with weather or with, you know, international incidents and things like that. As long as we can kind of try and control supply, you can sort of keep it predictable. So sometimes drill, baby, drill is good. Sometimes it's not great because you can crush the market with supply and then nobody's making any money. So.
Yeah, I think that's a reality. We haven't seen that really yet, but oil is a global commodity, right? So there's a global commodity price that drives that. But I think one of the big things that helps is, you know, their ability to export and things like that. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I guess if it did get so low that you had people kind of pull back from production, of course, that's going to kind of self-regulate the pricing, right, a little bit too. So I don't think you're going to be in a situation where you're not energy dominant just because you're slowing your production down. It just means you're trying to kind of stabilize the pricing market a little bit.
And certainly since I've been in the industry, you know, the ability to turn on and off production has gotten much better, right?
Yes.
It used to take months to frack a well, you know, drill and frack a well or a well pad or whatever. And now it seems like they're doing it in days.
Yes, very true.
And just real quick, it's been a long time and I'm a civil engineer, not a petroleum engineer, but I mean, like, you can frack the well and cap it, right? So essentially you're kind of, I mean, again, I'm free market, you know, and I appreciate affordable, but there is some levers that producers can play in that regard too, right? That can kind of help stabilize the markets, right?
Yeah, drilled and uncompleted, do track ducts is what they call them. You drill an uncompleted well.
Yeah.
Essentially the ability to turn stuff on pretty quick.
It's not like the 30s when you pop a well and it just came out and you had to get it when you got it.
Catch it in bottles. I guess just real quick, I know this is a new thing, but I am curious from you guys' perspective and kind of for what we do at GPA, what's the impacts on like processing capability? I mean, with the demand, with the supply, I mean, is this segment of the industry ready to take all that gas and change it to methane, ethane, propane?
The gas processing side, they're relatively quick and easy to build. And, you know, it's not like a oil refinery, right? That's kind of, I think, where our country's biggest bottleneck is refining processing capability. But as far as gas goes, I mean, it's a simpler, smaller process. You can do it in a lot of different areas. You don't have to funnel everything into one large area that has dock support and a lot of pipeline support. So that's beneficial. And yeah, it's basically just grown with demand. We've grown as producers come up and popping wells and we're building gas plants. So we've seen that, no issues on the production side. And our permitting's gotten a little more difficult. And I think one of the things Mike mentioned about that particulate matter, that's been a big one. So we're starting to see, you know, a little bit of issues with that, but luckily we're not in non-attainment areas and everything. So we kind of are able to get by with the permitting, but yeah, we've been able to keep up with demand for sure.
I keep wondering about manpower. You know, if there's so much construction going on with, these data centers and AI and grid updates, you know, whether that's transmission lines or substations or whatever that is, will that draw from our construction manpower base? I do know certainly people in oil and gas know how to make power, know how to do power facilities and things like that. So there is crossover. And so I'm just wondering, manpower definitely needs to be something that we keep on the radar as far as a shortage there. Like, you know, a midstream company might want to build a processing plant, but if a data center is going in next door, they got a couple thousand construction workers over there, whereas a gas processing plant might only take a couple hundred, but you can't get them, right? I mean, I'm using round numbers, but when we invest in infrastructure, that means a lot more people got to go work in the field.
And on top of that, maintaining the assets that you have, so skilled labor to actually run the plants and run the data centers and keep that up. That's another big thing that I think we're going to see a big, big market for is trained, skilled people.
Well, I guess we'll leave it there. Everybody, thanks for listening to us chat individually here and kind of give some different perspectives. We're going to try this new format and see how it goes, but we want to welcome everyone to reach out to us individually or the GPA Midstream specifically and provide feedback. Definitely leave comments on the videos or do whatever you got to do to reach out to us and let us know how it's going and if you got any thoughts. So guys, thanks for joining and look forward to next time.